On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. On the outside, Dr. Roy Berkowitz Shelton had it all. A wife he loved, two wonderful children, a thriving medical practice. But on the inside, the good doctor felt trapped, miscast in life. He felt, in fact, that he was, down deep, not a man, but a woman. A year ago, at the age of 52, he began living his life as a woman, and now is Dr. Deborah Burchell. This hour on Point, we'll hear her story. Joining me now in the studio is Deborah Burchell. She is a family physician with a private practice of nearly 20 years out of Davis Square in Somerville, Massachusetts. She was born Roy Shelton. In June 2006, Roy went through facial feminization surgery and returned to his practice and his life as Deborah Burchell. Dr. Burchell, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me here, Tom.
Okay. Thank you for coming, and thanks for your openness about this. We read about your story in the Boston Globe Sunday magazine, and we're just impressed with the sort of with your candor and openness in what clearly was a difficult challenge and has been a kind of an amazing journey. One that, I mean, many people do, but not many of us as a percentage take. And here you are on it. You presented to the world as a man for 50 years, and now you present and pretty well, I'd say, as a woman. Wow.
Well, it's. I would certainly like to take the wow out of this. I mean, for me, the goal actually was to live an ordinary life as a woman. And, you know, frankly, when I, you know, started out on this planet, I felt like I was leading a fairly ordinary life as a boy and as a man.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, always in the back of my mind, I had this feeling that I wanted to be a woman. But because of the way the society is structured, it was very easy for me to sort of say, okay, you're a normal man and you just have these feelings.
But you're a man, period.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I certainly was attracted to women. And I managed to have a wonderful marriage and a wonderful family, great friends. I'm involved with my synagogue. And basically what I found when I hit around 50 and my children were leaving home, going off to college, I found that I indeed had many blessings to count. And I would continually tell myself why I should be happy.
Mm-hmm.
But inside, I didn't feel happy. And I spent essentially my entire career working with my patients to try to bring out fulfillment for them.
As a physician, wanting them to be whole and healthy and happy.
Yeah. That perhaps you're aware that, you know, most people really get better for most of their illnesses on their own. And so when somebody would come in for a physical exam, sure, I would take care of their routine health problems, their typical ones, but I was always very interested in how they were doing with their marriages, what they were doing with their careers, how they were feeling internally.
The whole person.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I really tried to challenge my patients to attempt to reach a higher level of fulfillment. And I always had this disquieting feeling in the back of my mind that I wasn't doing that for myself. I tried not to look at it. But eventually, you know, it just became too much for me to take anymore. And I decided that I would investigate further and see if I really, in what way I needed to act on these inner feelings.
You've got a lot of patients, and that's an intimate relationship. People putting their personal stories, their physical health in your hands. You know, there came that time about a year ago now where you had a kind of facial surgery that feminized, and maybe you'll explain to us what that means. And at the same time, when you came back from that, you
announced, okay, I'm making this shift. And presumably for most or all of your patients, that came completely out of the blue. How did they take it?
Well, basically, I actually sent out a letter before the surgery, about a month before.
Okay.
I sent out a letter to my synagogue friends, to my local community, to my personal friends, and you know, about 3,000 letters to patients, their families, and to my colleagues, explaining what I was about to embark on.
Mm-hmm.
The response was almost uniformly positive. I mean, I was still quite concerned that I would be ridiculed, that patients would leave in droves. About 10 days before I sent out the letter, I said, I mean, I can't just see a person on day one, and then on day two, they get a letter from me. It would seem ridiculous. So I started to actually tell the patients directly, face to face. And I was amazed at the outpouring of good feeling toward me.
What was it? Maybe there was no typical response, but give us a sense of the first responses of your patients. I mean, this is kind of big news.
Yeah. It's
something most people don't do or potentially even ever run into directly in their lives. So how did people, you know, when you first put it out there, were people dumbstruck? Were they immediately? How was it?
Well, I would say about 50% of the patients developed a broad smile on their face, and they said, congratulations. And then another 50% said, makes no difference to me. You're my doctor.
Mm-hmm.
And you've always been a good doctor, and I'm going to be with you. And out of those approximately 200 patients that I told face-to-face, two of them eventually left, you know, and I certainly don't begrudge them for it. I mean, it's a difficult decision, just like my decision was difficult. I want people to be true to themselves, and I don't want to force people to have to be in a uncomfortable situation again because I'm handling such sensitive issues in their lives.
Mm.
And, you know, one of the patients actually was very angry with himself. He said, I'm so disappointed. I feel you were, you know, the most wonderful doctor that I ever had, and I have to leave you, and I can't believe I'm doing this. So,
were you upset with that patient, or
no,
do you see it as human nature? Some people can deal, and some can't.
Yeah, I'm trying to be honest with my life. I want people to be honest with their lives too, and to just be politically correct and say I have to stick with my doctor because she is because you know it's what's right. It's inappropriate probably for this kind of relationship.
Dr. Deborah Burchell is with us, having made the transgender journey from man to woman. And actually, we've got patients of yours calling in. Let's turn to one right now. Mary is calling from Somerville, Massachusetts. Mary, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
I am a new patient of Dr. Burchell, and I just wanted to call in total support. I had my first visit with Dr. Burchell recently. I got totally appropriate care, totally professional. This is someone who's interested in my continuing good health, and I'm delighted.
Did you know that Dr. Burchell, Deborah Burchell, had made this transition from presenting male to presenting female?
I did not know. And it's funny.
When did you learn?
This morning when I heard you on the earlier...
on the radio.
Radio, yeah.
So as far as you knew, Deborah Burchell was born and raised female.
Well, you know, I never thought about my doctor's plumbing much before, and I don't need to start now, really. So I don't think there's any reason to you know, judge that again. So,
well, Deborah, here's Mary. She came in knowing you only in your new presentation, and she's with you.
Yeah, well, that's wonderful. I really haven't had the opportunity. By this point, I don't even bother to bring it up anymore. The first month or so that I came back, I felt like I needed to give people the opportunity to get their feelings off their chest. And there were a few new patients that I offered my letter to just to make sure that they would be okay. But right now, really, you know, I feel as though I'm a woman. And in some ways, it's disrespectful of the patient to actually bring it up unless I sense that there's something disquieting about the encounter, which
you've
really
made the transition.
Is.
Here you are, and so off we go.
Right, and you know, in that regard, I'm really no different than the person down the street at the 7-Eleven who transitions. You know, that person also just wants to be treated like a woman. Unfortunately, I think in our society, I'm granted a bit of extra credibility because I'm a professional.
Mm-hmm.
And my message, one of the things I'd like to get across is that there are a lot of very ordinary people out there who are going through the same thing, and they deserve the right to live their lives the way they want to, too.
Mary, you've gone up a big learning curve this morning with your doctor. You comfortable where she stands and you stand?
Absolutely comfortable. And it's funny because I probably wouldn't have chosen the male doctor.
All right.
Well, you never know how it's going to go. Mary, thank you very much for your call. We're talking this hour with Dr. Deborah Burchell. She was born Roy Shelton. 1 year ago at 52, he became she. We're hearing her story, the transsexual story. Deborah Burchell, take us back in a little more detail, if you would, to how this unfolded in your life. I mean, you said you had some awareness as a child, that you were on a couple of different planes at once here. When were those conscious thoughts or feelings? When did you first begin to firm up in your mind a notion that, you know, here's how I am on the outside, but here's how I am, and it's different on the inside?
Well, I mean, when I was a little child, you know, I have some vague memories, perhaps at around 5 years of age, and that's actually significantly after gender is supposedly solidified in mm-hmm. your mind, that, you know, I wanted to dress in my mother's clothes. And then during my elementary school years, mm-hmm. so I spent a lot of time at night imagining myself being transformed into my elementary school teachers.
Who were women.
Who were women. They mm-hmm. were invariably women.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they were of all different, you know, types, backgrounds,
young, old,
ages.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But somehow I was caught up in that fantasy.
Did you think to yourself that this was strange, or was it just your inner conversation and you accepted it?
Yes, I think the latter, that it was my inner conversation. I accepted it. I didn't know what to make of it. This sort of continued on during my adolescence,
mm-hmm.
and I was attracted to women, what I thought of as in a normal heterosexual way, but I also was interested in wearing women's garb,
mm-hmm.
And putting on makeup, and I thought there was some association between that and sexual. There was something sexual associated with it. Let me say, it was arousing, and so I thought I was a cross dresser
mm-hmm.
or transvestite, and. And periodically, I would go through periods where I would cross-dress more, and then I would just throw away the clothes, as many transvestites do.
Throw away as in,
like,
this is just too awkward.
Like,
I can't
wrong,
be doing this.
This is
right.
evil.
Mm-hmm.
I can't do this.
Mm-hmm.
And I bottled it up inside. And, you know, that could go, that could, there could be a, you know, 5-7 year hiatus.
When did you begin to think, you know, I'm not just interested in women's clothing. I am inside a woman. That,
well,
when did it get articulated that way?
It started probably in my 40s, and I tried to. I'm very good at doing like self hypnosis, and I would try to imagine myself being a woman. But, you know, it's an obstacle that's rather insurmountable for for obviously normal gendered people, but for even for transgendered people, it's quite challenging. And I basically, you know, just never, I still didn't really know who I was until around 50, when I decided that I was going to see a therapist to try to, a person who sort of specializes in gender issues, mm-hmm. to try to sort through this, because I wanted to preserve my marriage and my family. And my wife was very supportive of me in trying to figure out who I was.
It was a close marriage. It was a love.
Yes. And so through this exploration and, you know, and through contact with other people who were transgendered, I started to get a better picture as to where I really lay on this matter. But it's believe me, it was quite a challenge the last 3 years.
By the time that you began to get that concrete in your understanding of your situation and the challenges around you, you had built up quite a structure of life as a male in the world, you know, a marriage, a family, a practice, and all the rest. How did you weigh this sort of inner need to express yourself as a woman against the weight of all that structure, against the investment of that a spouse had made in you as a man, against the expectations of your children, you know, in you as a father? That must have been I don't know. To me, I think that would be a kind of a terrible exercise in weighing this against that. How did you work through that?
Well, that's an interesting question, Tom, because it gets to the sort of the point of choice. And I feel that being the proper gender who you are is basically expressing who you are. It's sort of like an inalienable right. And so
comes even before choice.
I guess I would say it like this. If you're, let's say you are a slave and you're in this world where all the doors are shut, you learn to exist in this environment, and you have good times, bad times. You know you're a slave, but you know, you just say, "Well, okay, I'll make the best of it." And then one day you see a door, mm-hmm. and it's open, and you say, "Well, I could still choose to be here," but who in their right mind would choose to be enslaved and not walk through that door? So yes, there is a choice, but the choice is really about either being yourself or not being yourself. And I was hoping that I could run the gauntlet and somehow preserve my marriage and my family, mm-hmm. and my friends and my practice. And, I didn't quite make it all the way there. It's a terrible thing that, you know, some innocent people, especially my wife, has had a difficult time.
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course. Dr. Deborah Burchell, once Roy, now Deborah, is with us. Kenneth is calling from Sumter, South Carolina. Kenneth, you're on the air with Dr. Burchell.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi, Dr. Burchell. I just wanted to ask a question. I heard you mention earlier about your synagogue. I wanted to know, how did your church embrace you? Did they accept it? Coming from the eyes of God, when you're born male, you're male, and female, female. I'm just curious to know, how did they accept, or did they reject, or, you know, I'd just like to hear your comment on that.
Thank you, Kenneth.
Yeah, well, that's a good question. I belong to a conservative synagogue, and it's a fairly, the people that attend are, in general, from a fairly liberal background, but conservative Judaism is traditional Judaism. And so basically, from a personal perspective, I was fairly well embraced by most of the members of the congregation, and they've been supportive. The rabbis have been supportive. But that doesn't mean that there aren't some members of the congregation that are having a difficult time. And my wife is a member of that congregation too, an active member. And I think it's, you know, from a personal point of view, it's been challenging, I think, for some members of my synagogue and for some of our mutual friends.
What about you at a religious level? I mean, you've had the facial reconstruction surgery. You're scheduled now to go ahead and have, like, as our earlier call, Mary put it, the full plumbing surgery. In religious terms, I mean, Kenneth is kind of asking, well, if God gave you this male body,
right?
You know, maybe that's what you were intended to have. Was that even an issue with you?
Not basically. I mean, certainly the pat answer that traditional Christians give to this is, if God is perfect, then God made me this way, and so therefore, this is what I was meant to do. This is what He gave me, this brain that told me that I was of the opposite gender than I was granted the genes
mm-hmm.
for.
Mm-hmm.
But since I'm not a fundamentalist in my belief system, this really isn't hard for me to handle. In traditional Judaism, you are not supposed to alter your body in any fashion, but I'm going to live with this without any heartache.
Mm. Kenneth, thanks for your call. Dr. Burchell, if you'll stand by for just a second, I want to invite one more medical voice into this conversation for a few minutes. Joining us from Boston is Norman Spack, Dr. Norman Spack, senior endocrinologist at Children's Hospital in Boston, assistant professor of pediatrics at Harvard Medical School, and co-founder and co-director of Gender Management Service at Children's Hospital. Dr. Spack, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
You deal with a lot of people who are going through what Deborah Burchell has just gone through. Describe this world, and I'm not sure what to call it, syndrome or situation for us. How common is it? How uncommon? When do people tend to wake up to this irresistible urge to be something that their body would tell them that perhaps they're not?
Well, it's really quite fascinating because I don't think we have a full handle on how many people really are transgendered. And I say that because we know many of the original statistics were taken from those who have sought the most advanced surgery, such as what I call the genital reconstruction surgery.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't call it sex reassignment surgery, and in fact,
though many people do.
I know. Those mm-hmm. are the standard terms, but even some of my European colleagues are trying to train me not to say things like presenting as male but as or female, but as affirming their original gender,
okay.
Because that's really, how can you transition from something that you already are?
So as a doctor, you would say at this point, despite the physical evidence of one gender or another, it's this inner sense that's really the defining
right
character. Is that the accepted medical view?
I'm giving you my opinion,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and there are a lot of opinions on this. I have the remarkable, and this is somewhat later in my career, in the last 20 years, have accumulated a very considerable experience. And you may ask why someone from Children's Hospital, a pediatric endocrinologist, is into this. It actually started out working with young adults post-college
mm-hmm.
in an adolescent practice. And then because of the retirement and moving away and the death of a number of senior physicians who cared for adults, I agreed to take care of adults. So I was actually taking care of many, many people of Deborah's age.
Is there a large demand?
Yes. The demand that I'm feeling right now is actually coming from the younger and younger. People who are, now that it's out there,
mm-hmm.
I see this in many ways as what gay was in the coming out of the 60s into the 70s.
So a kind of liberation movement of
exactly.
the gender within?
Exactly. People who would never, the Deborahs of her youth who would not have considered coming forward may now go to a college where on the resident application form
mm-hmm.
it may ask, who do you want to room with? Question 3, are you trans?
Is there a hurdle to be cleared before the kind of fairly radical surgery you're talking about is offered? Do you have to be persuaded of something, of some level of commitment or existence?
Absolutely.
How do you measure that? How do you know when it's not just, let's say, a fleeting thought or confusion or,
absolutely.
You know?
Absolutely. This is very important. Some people are of the opinion that that people just willy-nilly go forward with surgery. Surgery is a very, very end or late stage process in an extremely long process of intensive evaluation by highly specialized gender specialists.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
In the case of younger people, including families, often including spouses, and then people have to live in the gender of affirmation for at least a year on hormones.
Mm-hmm. Hormones, but no surgery, no genital surgery.
Nobody will touch them. Mm-hmm. Or should there are standards of care that are international that were set up by an organization I'll call WPATH, World Professional Association for Transgender Health, who was named for Harry Benjamin. So they're called the Benjamin Standards, which clearly outline what the amount of time a person has to be in therapy. For example, I will not see a person unless I have a letter from a person I trust as a gender specialist who has been working over an extended period of time with this person, because my involvement as a non-surgeon is, and as an endocrinologist, is to help them affirm their gender identity through the alteration in their body hormonal chemistry.
Hormonally. Dr. Burchell, did you have any fear of this sort of measurement? Were you confident when you as you began to step up and seek the hormone therapy, were you confident that the medical establishment would greet you, assess you, and help you?
Yeah, I was fairly confident that would occur. It is not the case for many people in the transgender community. For, you know, they're trying to keep things secretive from other family members. They don't have money to see gender therapists. Some of the youth really have no understanding of how to go about seeking health care. And so, there are some parts of the country where there are clinics that look at risk reduction, and they will assess people in a very different way than what Dr. Spack is talking about.
Dr. Spack, we've just got you for a few more seconds. Is there any number on this? Is it 1 in 1,000, 1 in 100,000? Do you have any idea how often this occurs, happens?
Well, I think that the original statistic listed was 1 out of 10,000. It's certainly probably, if anything, more common than that. And if you look at the old literature, it says that it's 10 times more common to be a Deborah, a genetic male seeking a female identity, affirming a female, than to be a female to a male identity. But that's, my contacts in the trans community think it's probably closer to 1 to 1. And in my own practice, it's probably 3 to 1.
Dr. Spack, thanks very much for being with us. Terry's calling from New Haven, Connecticut. Terry, you're on the air with Dr. Burchell.
Thank you. Hello. This is a very compelling subject. I'm interested in the perception that Dr. Burchell would have of the past life. Is it like a continuum, or does it seem like the life as a male was someone else, and someone else's life, a dream in a way? I mean, were you as Dr. Shelton still part of you as Dr. Burchell? Obviously, the children, would connect you, but that's my question.
It's sort of almost a literary interpretation of the path Dr. Burchell's been on.
Yes.
Yeah, well, I can't speak for the way other transsexuals will feel about this, but for me, I feel it's more of a continuum. Sure, there was a sudden change in after I had facial feminization surgery. I went from living full time as Roy Berkowitz Shelton to living full time as Deborah Burchell. From one day to the next. But
do you feel like the same person that you were then, just expressed differently, or
I feel. At peace with myself in a way I never felt before. I would say that that's the biggest change that occurs. Life just feels right. I felt like I was walking around with two left feet. I think most people thought that I was reasonably happy, and basically I was. But I would be, as I like to describe it, I would be sitting in a movie theater enjoying the movie, and after 10 minutes I would be saying, this is a great movie, what am I going to be doing next? And now...
Because there was just an unease somewhere within?
I just knew I needed to fill my life up with things that pleased me, because inside I wasn't pleased. You know, I counted my blessings as Roy and as Deborah. I feel blessed. I don't need anything to feel good as Deborah.
Do you ever wake up out of a daydream or a nap or I don't know what and forget that you're now Deborah? You've worked on how you move and how you do present. Do you slip back? Does your voice lower? Do you find yourself walking like a jock and say, wait a minute, that was then and this is now, I'm Deborah?
I think that basically, you know, I've been acculturated as a male, and so I will naturally have a tendency to, you know, for my voice to lower in pitch, or I will tend to walk in a less than feminine manner, because that I really did have to train. But I'm not trying to do anything to be Deborah. I am being myself. My persona fits that of a woman, in my opinion, much better than that of a male. But
do your friends say about that? Have you kept the same set of friends?
Yes, to a large degree, I have. I mean, they've been incredibly supportive, and they try to be supportive of my wife too. I think,
but they were friends to you, and they knew you at least categorically as a male. So, you know, you might wonder if when you sit around with them, do they want to, like, you know, I don't know, throw beers back, or, you know, do their expectations push you back toward Roy?
Oh, well, that's a good point. I mean, I think that the fact that I am surrounded by most people who knew me as Roy, it probably makes it a little more challenging to just, you know, really feel like I'm Deborah.
Yeah.
Than if I moved to another part of the country, nobody knew me. But I'm happy. I mean, I do look at this as a continuum. I don't need to have a slam dunk, 100% perfect existence as Deborah.
What about your children?
My children both have been incredibly perceptive and understanding about this situation.
College age, children learning, whoa, right. Dad is going in a new direction.
My son was totally accepting, and at the time he was actually essentially Orthodox Jew, fully observant of all Jewish law, keeping the Sabbath, etc. Mm-hmm. He was immediately okay. I was actually concerned that he would have a difficult time looking at
because
it.
Because that orthodoxy would somehow cut him off from your change.
That it would not necessarily cut him off from me as a human being, but that, you know, there are rules, and this is just not part of a traditional orthodoxy. My daughter was immediately understood the ramifications for the family, for her mother, and she was very concerned about her mother, and she understood what it meant for me. It's been very painful for her. It's been a big challenge for her. And we're going to have a long road ahead, I think, to get back to the kind of wonderful relationship we had before. I think we will.
Are you confident somewhere that you'll be able to be a father to your children?
I don't care to be a father.
Father is loaded with, you know, it's male.
I don't care to be a father. I'm happy to be a parent. Mm-hmm. Other transsexuals, men who transition to women who transition to men. I mean, they're happy to remain mothers or fathers, as they were before. I don't feel comfortable being called a father at this juncture. A parent, yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm a loving parent.
Mm. Let's go to Kevin in Boston. Kevin, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Great show.
Thank you.
I'm wondering if transgenderism at all is a spectrum or access or mere cross-dresser is just somebody who can't let go of their masculinity. Is there some way to determine in the part of the brain where the difference between a male and female?
Well, that's an excellent question, and the $64,000 question. Nobody really knows. There are clearly many cross-dressers who do transition later in life. The vast majority probably do not. I mean, there are some statistics that are quoted that up to 3% of people are transgendered. This would include, gender queers, people who present in an androgynous way. But I do believe there is a spectrum of gender. Very few people are 100% all male or all female. And it's an excellent question. I don't care to give you a definitive answer because it's impossible.
But is there a physiological answer? I was reading, this spring at the LA Times, their sports writer at the LA Times, Mike Penner, wrote a column, and he said, I'm taking a few days vacation. He's been a sports writer for many years at the LA Times. And when I come back from my vacation, it's going to be as Christine. Uh-huh. This was Mike going to Christine. He said, I'm a transsexual sports writer. But he wrote there, it's interesting, he said, a transgender friend provided the best and simplest explanation that I've heard. He said, we are born with this. We fight it as long as we can. And in the end, it wins. He wrote, he's not a doctor, but he wrote, recent studies have shown that physiological factors as genetics and hormonal fluctuations during pregnancy can significantly affect how our brains are wired at birth. Relative to gender, I guess. Is there a literature on that?
Yeah, there's that seems to be fairly well established, in other animal models and in humans, that in order for you to develop a male pattern brain, you have to have some exposure to testosterone in utero while you're developing in your mother's womb, and then there's maybe shortly after birth another burst of testosterone. Whether transsexual male to females don't get that or not, I think it's very challenging to prove. There's a study done by Gorin, multiple studies done by Gorin, where he looked at brains of transsexuals who died, both male to female and female to male, and certain parts of the hypothalamus are actually patterned like the opposite gender that these people were born into, and some of these people had not gotten hormones. A good book, honestly, for a layperson. My husband Betty was a godsend to me. It was written by Helen Boyd, and it was designed as a book to support partners of transgendered folk. But it is really quite. It has an extensive. Array of information on this subject if you're curious to find out more.
I should say you also can link to Dr. Deborah Burchell's webpage and the Boston Globe magazine piece on her, which including with text and photos and video at our website, onpointradio.org. Let's take a call from Marianne in Dorchester, Massachusetts. Marianne, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
I have a social question for Dr. Burchell. Mm-hmm. I have a friend who's transgendered, now a female, but we were friends for so many years and did so many things together back when she was still a he, that when we're talking about these things in company and all, and I say, oh yeah, I remember when he and I went on this trip, because when we went on the trip, he was a he.
Mm-hmm.
Now she's a she. I have no trouble with the present, but how does he feel or she feel about when people are reminiscing or talking about things in the past when she was a he? Is it?
Yeah, the semantics around this, they're kind of politically loaded, and some people are very, uptight about it. How do you look at it, Deborah Burchell? He, she,
well,
then, now, ever?
Well, I think, I'm fairly fortunate in not taking – I'm not very self-conscious about this. But there are others who, this is a great struggle for people, and they still walk around quite self-conscious about being accepted as the gender who they desire to be. So for me, I don't care if people make mistakes. I think I would have had a hard time going back to my practice if I was overly worried that somebody might call me refer to me as he or whatever. Mm-hmm. I can't say that it's the one most wonderful thing if people flub. Mm-hmm. I can't say that when people read my voice as male on the telephone, they don't know who it is, mm-hmm. that it doesn't, you know, zing me a little bit. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I'm actually more concerned about the human rights issue, that the fact that, you know, I can practice my career as a doctor because I'm self-employed, and somebody like Steve Stanton in Largo, Florida, he lost his job even though he had accolades and performance.
What was his job?
He was the city manager, mm-hmm. and the mayor and the assistant mayor were very supportive of him, and his family supportive of him.
He transitioned male to female?
He announced that he was transitioning. Mm-hmm. I actually don't know if he has transitioned to mm-hmm. Susan yet. I mm-hmm. call it she has transitioned to Susan yet.
But it cost him a job, ultimately.
Yes. And then there's the 21-year-old trans woman at UMass Amherst who couldn't get a job this summer because she looked androgynous. And this is liberal Amherst, Northampton and Amherst.
It's human nature. People are not necessarily comfortable with that ambiguity.
But I understand it's going to take a long time. Mm-hmm. It's going to take a long time.
Let's take a call from Annie in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Annie, you're on the air with Dr. Burchell.
Hi, Dr. Burchell. This is Annie. My son was a former patient of yours, and we talked on the phone. I'm totally supportive of your soul's journey. I'm just really concerned that we still fight the fight for gender equality in the world. And what bothers me, you know, when my son was in your care, he was a boy at 4 who wore skirts. And when I said to you, you know, my boy is wearing skirts, you turned to him and you said, what sports are you into? And that made me feel like, you know what, I'm not going to bring up issues around gender again.
How long ago was this, Annie?
This was about 8 years ago.
So, well before Deborah, back in the day of Roy, Dr. Purcell...
Back in the day of Roy, and I felt like, oh, well, you know, because my son, to me, he's a role model. He's a boy who is occupying, you know, he could wear nail polish, he has long hair, you know, but he says, I'm a boy who likes to wear skirts.
But you wanted a doctor who affirmed that. You didn't have it then. Dr. Burchell, what about now, if the same thing came up?
Well, I can't really address, you know, perhaps Annie is referring to the gestalt that she got from the meeting, because I feel girls and boys should be active physically, and I don't want to exclude that question when I'm with girls. I don't want to expect that girls are going to be wanting to necessarily play with dolls. I think in part, though, there may have been some discomfort on, you know, at that point, because I was in denial of who I was. And I certainly apologize if I caused any hurt or pain for you know, Annie and her son at that time.
Let's get one more call quickly from Larry in Norwood, Massachusetts. Larry, you're on the air. We just got a minute and a half.
Hi, Dr. Burchell. I just basically want to call and voice my opinion of, I mean, my late fiancé, Jean O'Connell's opinion and my opinion of Dr. Burchell. Jeannie has passed away July 2nd and was a, Dr. Burchell was primary care doctor for her. And Jeannie told me many times that she would defend Dr. Burchell's decision to anyone at any time. And Jeannie was very comfortable being with Dr. Burchell as her primary care doctor. And I got to meet Dr. Burchell while Jeannie was in hospice in late June, just before Jeannie passed. And I myself, you know, had an open mind when I met Dr. Burchell, did not think, you know, at that moment while he was coming into the house to look at Jeannie, that he had previously been a male. Mm-hmm. I accepted that he was a woman. And from what I saw, Dr. Burchell's treatment of Jeannie that day and the care and love for her patient, I really feel that Dr. Burchell has just been a lucky person to be living in a day where they can reaffirm their gender, just like people can change their weight by having gastric bypass surgery or different medications. They're lucky. She's lucky to be, you know, alive now. And Jeannie felt that Dr. Burchell was a great doctor.
Larry, we're grateful for your call. We're sorry for your loss, but when the chips were down, Dr. Burchell was there for your genie. Deborah Burchell, now life stretches out in front of you, kind of all new. Does it look like a new lease to you? Like a, I don't know, a new life?
I think, as I sort of implied before, it feels like a real life and a pleasant life, and I'm really looking forward to the years ahead.
We thank you so much for sharing so candidly. We thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
Dr. Deborah Burchell. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.